Well, you're enjoying the best of the Adam Carolla Show, and if you want to do your best, click the banner at adamcarolla.com before you do your Amazon shopping. God bless you, and enjoy some Mangria as well. Also, The Spoils of Babylon, Eric John Rosch's epic novels now, an epic miniseries. It's coming to IFC Thursday, January 9th. I've seen snippets. Hysterical. It's a six-part miniseries. It features big names. Kristen Wiig. Does she really need the two eyes there? Would there be confusion if there was just one eye? Kristen Wiig. Tobey Maguire. Will Ferrell. Jessica Alba. Val Kilmer. Haley Joel Osment. Tim Robbins. Michael Sheen. A lot of big names in this bad boy. Be nice to see my name in one of these just once. Anyway, be a pro ace, man. The premiere night will include two back-to-back episodes, The Spoils of Babylon, IFC, Thursday, January 9th at 10, 9 Central. Do not miss that. And without any further ado, enjoy one of the best guests we've ever had, documentarian Ken Burns.
This is Carolla Digital.
Well, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. I feel weird saying that in front of Ken Burns, documentarian and all-around good guy. Ken has a new documentary coming out September 28th and 29th. That is coming up this September 28th and 29th on PBS. It's called Baseball, and it's the 10th inning. We've already done it's 94-2. Yesterday?
92 to yesterday.
Oh, 92 to yesterday.
Yeah, we came out in 94 with our 9-episode, 9-inning, 18-and-a-half-hour, which you think would be enough, to which we've added two hours, so we have 4 more hours.
What's your longest documentary to date?
Baseball, and now Baseball plus the 10th inning.
I saw The War, which is just unbelievable.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think, is it, how much of what you do is just dogged determination and patience? Meaning, you know, if you're Bruckheimer, it's a different part of your brain, I guess, you're,
yes,
you're using.
I think
if
so.
You're making a film and you're making one that's just involved in, like, you know, what if somebody says, we need a documentary on the Civil War, and you have 7 weeks to do it? It's impossible.
We say,
right?
No to. Yeah, no, we want to... You know, most documentaries are, or at least in the past, documentaries have been homework. You know, they're castor oil, something you know is good for you. It's somebody telling you what you should know. And we avoid that. We'd like to tell you something we've discovered. So our whole process gets attenuated because we don't have a research period followed by a scripting period and then follow the template that script represents through shooting and editing. Mm-hmm. We never stop researching. We never stop writing. We're the last day of editing. We're rewriting something in the stuff. So it takes a really long time, but allows you to add layers of nuance and to get stuff that you didn't get, to have, you know, very complex parallel constructions in the structure of the film. And it's the only way I know how to do it. I've been doing that for 35 years, and that's it.
Is castor oil the same as cod liver oil?
Yes,
and then
it is.
Which one tastes worse?
They're both bad? They're both very, very bad to taste. And they're really, really good for you.
Really?
You literally have to hold your nose and you go like this and you think that people had to take it every single day. And they did. Like my dad took it every single day, and that's why it explains a lot.
Have you ever? That's why he's so angry and
yes,
holding his nose
exactly.
All the time.
Exactly.
And have you ever had brewer's yeast, by the way?
Yes, I have.
That's another thing that's supposed to be good for you that tastes horrible.
It's
why
not
would God
so bad.
Do this? Do a documentary on
why
God would punish us.
The punishment of all the good stuff is like...
Yeah, why are ho-hos delicious but are going to kill you, but cod liver oil
and tofu,
brewer's yeast
and
tofu. Do a doc on that.
I had a patch where I would sometimes sprinkle brewer's yeast on grapefruit, and it was actually all right. And it was like a granola-y thing.
But it's almost like when martial artists punch a piece of birch,
yes,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Like that's just you trying to toughen up your palate,
okay,
right?
Okay, no, well, you know,
you're taking the two worst tasting things on the planet and combining them.
See, I think it all went wrong when Thomas Jefferson said, he could have followed John Locke and said, life, liberty, and property. We understand that. Get the hell off my gland, or I'm going to shoot you. But he said pursuit of happiness, and we didn't know what that meant. And was the pursuit of the happiness after things in a marketplace, or was it a lifelong learning of the mind and the heart, which is what I think it was.
Right.
But I think a lot of it has been, we think that we are deserving of happiness, and that anything that's friction, difficult, oppositional, like castor oil,
yeah,
brewer's yeast, and tofu, it's not for us.
Well,
so we're fat. We're dying of heart disease. We have diabetes.
Right.
And
we think we're happy, but we're not.
And we think we're happy, but we're not.
Well, you know, I've always said this, that the best way to, I always talk about this when I talk about comedy, which is it needs a little pathos mixed in there to make the comedy pay off.
Mark Twain said, "The source of laughter is not joy, but sorrow. There is no laughter in heaven."
Hold on. Google Matt Twain?
Mark Twain.
Mark Twain.
He's a famous American.
A lot of our listeners don't know.
Famous American writer, yeah.
Yeah, all right. We're going to check that
He wrote, yeah, he's a pretty pretty Twain funny
restaurant.
Dude.
You know Twain's. Yeah,
Twain's.
There's a restaurant.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's true. I always say...
He also said, by the way, that it's not that the world is filled with fools. It's just that lightning isn't distributed right. Which
wow.
Will be funny in 1,000 years when no other humorist from the 19th century has any. I mean, when they fired in the back of Lincoln's brain in Our American Cousin, which was a comedy, the line that got the laugh that gave Booth the sort of the cover to shoot was, "You sockdologizing old man trap."
Really?
It's really not funny now,
right,
considering
but,
what happened.
But that's what created the laughter in the theater.
Yeah, you sockdologizing old man trap, ah ha ha, poof, like that. But Twain.
Right.
The things he said, like lightning being distributed right, is going to be around. And if we haven't gotten rid of our species in 1,000 years, that will still be funny.
Well, it's funny because there's a Nick Cage movie. You know, every Nick Cage movie either involves some historical event, like
right.
Lincoln being shot, or the extinction of our species.
Exactly.
So
right.
He's doing double
right,
duty.
He's heading backwards or forwards.
Well, speaking of... I was thinking about this before you started talking about Matt Twain and what his legacy was and is. I was thinking for you and the work that you do, this stuff it's forever, and it's the first time that it was, I mean, these things have been documented in various ways, shapes, and forms. There's been a lot of, you know, World at War kind of stuff,
yep.
World War II. And there's been plenty of documentaries made on baseball, but not a definitive sort of, we took everything and put it under one roof
right.
kind of collection. And so 100 years from now or 2,000 years from now, when somebody wants to know about the World War II or when they want to know about baseball, they'll go to your work, theoretically.
That
and that's
nice.
Got to be a pretty nice
Well, you know,
feeling.
A lot of it is exciting. And it's nice to see that they are evergreen. And you hope that the emotional archaeology that we are partaking in will last and be durable, that it isn't just going to be about the buckle collectors or the guys who are interested in the caliber of the guns or the movement of regiments, but a human story that we try to tell. The Civil War was bottom-up as well as top-down. The World War II, of which it's the only film that I've ever done in which the territory was filled with other projects, hundreds, thousands of documentaries. But no one had decided to try to tell the two theaters, the European and the Pacific Theater, simultaneously as they happened. World of War didn't do it. Nobody did a Victory at Sea. And nobody tried to then also fold in the home front as well as a bottom-up thing. So we took four geographically distributed American towns, Waterbury, Connecticut, Mobile, Alabama, Sacramento, California, and tiny, tiny Laverne, Minnesota, and said, let's see the war through their eyes,
right.
How they went off to the war. It didn't mean that it was any limited in that way. The scope could be global, but you could find the universe in a grain of sand.
What are some of the documentaries that you've liked over the years, other than all of yours, which Ken normally says we rattles off his 15 and then he gets to everyone else's. But what are some that have moved you, or maybe ones that you saw when you were younger that made you want to get into this?
Yeah, I know. I actually, my mom died when I was 11, and my dad had a really strict curfew. But if there was a movie on TV that lasts till 1 a.m. on a school night, he'd let me stay up and watch it, like an old movie. Or he'd take me to the Cinema Guild or to the Revival House, where I'd see European stuff as well. And I watched my dad cry for the first time, and I realized, like 12 or 13 years old, this is what I want to do. Because I understood why he hadn't been able to deal with the stuff going on in our family, but he could deal with it through a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the power of the medium. So I wanted to be Howard Hawks or John Ford or some such other director of the time. And then I went to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts in 71, and everybody was a social documentary still photographer. They were interested in the truth of what is and what was. And all of a sudden, I had my molecules rearranged, and I'm now interested in doing documentaries. And that combined with a completely untrained interest in history to start doing this sort of stuff. And that's where it came from.
My stepdad took me to see Smoking the Bandit once when I was 13, and that was my experience with the cinema. You know what's kind of nice is, you know, if you want to make movies, you're going to take your lumps. I mean, if you want to get into this business, I don't care how much money you've made. I mean, you know, Robert De Niro has 5 stinkers, you know. Marlon Brando has a few stinkers in there. Everybody has a couple of stinkers, even the great directors and the writers and blah, blah, blah. The thing that's got to be nice about making documentaries is... I'm sure some are received better than others, but you never get any 1.5 stars on any of these babies, do you?
No. I mean, every once in a while you get a critic who's decided that they're going to take you down for the pretentiousness with which you've decided to approach baseball or some other such thing. Or maybe you find a jazz or Roddy guy who thinks that, you know, because you left out the second sideman in Count Basie's band between 47 and 48, you failed miserably, that you weren't the telephone book.
So you do have some credits.
And so it's a really nice sort of thing. And it's kind of cool to be able to respond to them. Because you always go and you say, okay, so who of today's, or criticism that you didn't do modern jazz guys, I would say, who are of today's jazz guys are as important as Louis Armstrong or Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, John Coltrane? And they'll go, well, we won't know for 25 years. I go, yeah, and that's called history,
right?
You know?
And there's your answer.
And there's your answer.
So now, baseball, and are these doc, as far as picking a documentary, and you get pissed off when people call it a doc, like I get pissed off when people call Curb Your Enthusiasm Curb?
I hate it only when they call me K. But doc's okay. I don't ever use it. When people say, yeah, I like docs, meaning they don't like docs.
In terms of deciding, I mean, I assume you like jazz and you like baseball.
Yep.
And
I didn't know it. I mean, I knew baseball. I grew up. I don't remember a time when in the little movies of myself there wasn't a mitt in my left hand. Instantly working on baseball way back when, I realized how little I knew. So every film essentially has been a complete immersion into something else. And that's better that way, because you don't want me to tell you what you should know. You want me to say, hey, I got to tell you what I just learned. That's always better than the sharing of discovery rather than, and there'll be a quiz tomorrow.
Yeah. You don't want to get preachy.
Yeah.
You want to take people on a journey of discovery. And so do you have your topics sort of lined up where, you know, here's what we're going to get to down the road?
Yeah, I've got a sort of Stalinist 10-year plan going on right now. So after baseball, the 10th inning, next year is Prohibition. The year after that is the Dust Bowl, which Prohibition is done. We locked the picture. Dust Bowl, we're just beginning editing. We're just beginning editing a big thing on the history of the Roosevelts, Theodore Franklin and Eleanor. Believe it or not, no one's told them as a connected family drama. They've done Theodore, book and film. They've done Franklin, book and film, sometimes Franklin and Eleanor. But they're all related. She was born with the last name. And then beyond that, Vietnam. We're also doing a film in the Central Park Jogger case. Those black and Hispanic boys accused of wilding and served their term in jail didn't do it. And
what happened to wilding? I feel like it was all the rage about 10 years ago.
Well, it was invented by folks at that 1989 thing, and these kids didn't do it.
See if my son can bring that back at the public pools in a few years. Just you know, kind of old school. Well, so now... Do people pitch you topics?
We just do our own stuff. It's within our own. These are all handmade, so there's a half dozen of us.
But does somebody ever go, hey, man, how about that Lindbergh baby? And you go, yeah, what about that Lindbergh baby? And then they tell you a couple things, and you go,
That's happened a couple of times. I made a film on Huey Long. I actually helped a friend make a film on Lindbergh for exactly that reason, you know, 20 years ago. But yeah, no, somebody says, look at this footage of Huey Long giving a speech. Mm-hmm. And it made Broderick Crawford, who was got an Oscar for All the King's Men in 1948 or 49, it put him to shame. I mean, the real Huey Long was so much more interesting, just like the real Jack Johnson, the film that we made a few years ago, was much more interesting than The Great White Hope.
I don't know if I saw your version of the, you know, Jack Johnson, but Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight, and really the first, I mean, he was long before black athletes had made it into, you know, mainstream sports.
They had a gentleman's agreement that no black could fight for the heavyweight championship, and this was a decade in which more African Americans were lynched than in any other time, and he's not only beating up white people, he's marrying white women, and this could not stand.
And transporting them across the county.
Well, that's all ex post facto. That's how when they couldn't beat him in the ring, when they couldn't find a great white hope to beat him, and they found, they pulled out many, and he dispatched them all, then they went after him for his private life. Nothing that any other boxer, white, or baseball player, or even statesman, the great black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, said. It all comes down then to his unforgivable blackness, and so we called our film Unforgivable Blackness, because that was what it.
Unbelievable story. And again, the 45 years before Jackie Robinson.
And before Muhammad Ali. Like, we think Muhammad Ali is the greatest of all time, and we feel also sympathy for the trials that he, you know, his government went after him in a decade we now say was dedicated to civil rights, the 60s. Well,
right.
I can tell you that between 1905 and 1915, which is Jack Johnson's huge period, that was a decade dedicated to getting rid of as many black people as we could.
Did you, in your baseball doc, cover the story, and are you aware of what is quite possibly my favorite baseball story of all time, which is a minor league catcher with a man on third base jumped up and did that move after the pitch where he was going to fire the ball down the third base line and see if he could pick off the guy who was taking a little too big a lead, threw what looked like the ball way over the head of the third baseman. The guy on third base saw the ball go sailing into left field and jogged into home plate.
Only to be tagged out.
Only to be tagged out.
By the rosin bag? Was what went?
He threw a potato.
Well, I think, you know, the baseball rules now strictly forbid it. We don't know this, but stop the presses. We have got to open up this 10th inning and add that.
Cut it. Break it. Break it open, because get out the habit. This guy threw a potato. He came out onto the field with a potato. He threw the potato. The guy trotted in. And he touched him with the ball, and then he got fired the following day.
I'm sure.
But either way, I always thought it was the funniest thing ever that the guy brought a potato out
of the
field.
They still try the hidden ball trick. They do all that stuff. It's so, the game
I did
is
it
so
in the celebrity softball game. It works like a charm.
It does, of course.
It has to work. You
it
do
has
that thing
to
where
work.
You just go, I'm going to go talk to the pitcher.
You
talk
come
to
back,
the pitcher.
Say,
you
how
walk
you doing?
Back. He takes his lead off, and you touch him on the head.
Yeah.
It should be illegal, but anyway. The next, so we're talking about, you got a
10th inning.
Oh, the 10th inning.
Yeah.
Sorry. We're talking about that. Now what, so that covers 92.
Yeah. So the last, the thing that came out in 94 when the strike season, we came out when, and we thought we were going to be competing with other baseball, and we weren't. We were the only thing on. The
right.
last bit of action we described was the 1992 World Series between the Phillies and the Toronto Blue Jays, which mm-hmm. Toronto won in a walk-off by Joe Carter.
Yeah.
We back up to the NLCS, where a young, skinny Barry Bonds fails to throw Sid Bream out at the plate mm-hmm. in the bottom of the ninth in Atlanta, and Atlanta wins the pennant. The Pirates go down, Atlanta's ascendant, and that's the last play that this young Barry Bonds will play. And it's his narrative, his arc of his biography is sort of the underlying story, because, of course, he's going to carry both the promise and the shadow, the peril of baseball over the next two decades. That are, if you separate out, say, the 40s when Jackie Robinson came up, were the most consequential. The last two have been among the most consequential that we've ever had, with the strike, with the specter of steroids, but also enormously dramatic performances. The Braves and their 14 consecutive division titles. Joe Torre making some sense of the Bronx Zoo. The home run chase, the strike, and the aftermath of Cal Ripken and the rise of Latin players. And then 9/11 and Ichiro and Barry Bonds as a Giant and his postseason woes. And the Red Sox being defeated again in 2003 and then coming back in the greatest comeback.
Red Sox coming back down 3-0 to the Yankees.
It's highlight. Listen, I live in New England. I've lived in New England for 40 years. When that happened in 2004, it was the first time the antenna went up and you said, you know, maybe we should do this. And then it wasn't until 2 years later when the specter of steroids was so, it was just being shoved up everybody's butt that I just thought, I've got to go back and treat it. We have to figure out a way to put it in perspective because, you know, in 1977, George Foster hits 50 home runs. Cecil Fielder does it for the Tigers in 90. Mm-hmm. And that was it. A 50 home run season was a rarity. Then all of a sudden, middle infielders were hitting 50 home runs.
Right.
I could hit 50 home runs.
Sure.
And then now it's a rarity again. So stuff got inflated, home run stuff, but there weren't that many more 300 hitters. Nobody hit 406 as Ted Williams did in 41. No one went on a 56-game hitting streak as DiMaggio did, also in 41. So in some ways, with baseball going from the worst testing to now the best testing in professional sports, you feel like if the genie's not back in the bottle, at least the steroids era is a little bit in the rearview mirror.
Well, so the thing that's interesting about the steroid era is the home runs went up, but you're saying no one hit 400 and nobody hit as well as a lot of the guys hit 40 years earlier.
Yeah.
So did it just add power? What's your assertion there?
I think basically the ball popped a little bit more because of the muscle mass that they were building up. We're always going to have to deal with it. But you know what? Baseball, where statistics really matter, they don't matter in the other sports.
No.
How many points does Will Chamberlain have?
55,221. I'm a huge no, I have no idea.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Just fucking
okay.
around with
yeah.
it.
So we know how many Babe Ruth has. We know how many Hank Aaron has.
Sure.
You know, so it matters here. But you still need to tell a story. Like if I ask you who won the 1919 World Series and you looked it up, it would say the Cincinnati Red Stockings. But then you go, wait a second. Wasn't that the Black Sox scandal when the White Sox threw it because Arnold Rothstein and other gamblers paid them to do that? Yes, it was. But it still says the Cincinnati Red Stockings won that. It doesn't say Babe Ruth, he never had to play against the Negro Leagues, which were clearly, once they were allowed in belatedly and in a quota system, so much better than anybody else, that he never had to pitch against them or fly to the other side of the coast to play a night game or split-fingered fastball or all this other stuff, or that Bobby Thompson was stealing the signs and knew exactly what Ralph Branca was going to pitch to him in the 1951 one-game playoff between
the
Dodgers and the Giants.
Yeah.
So everything requires a story, and that's why we wanted to do
it. But to be fair to Babe, he was getting drunk on trains and whoring. So I would say that makes up for jet lag and split-finger fastball.
I agree totally.
He probably saw four balls coming at him.
And hit them all.
And he had to hit with that crown and the cigar in his mouth.
Right, and the fur coat
and the
on.
Fur coat.
And the honk honk car.
Hot day in New York. That's going to be rough.
It's tough.
So as far as then something like steroids in general, because I actually flew out to Chicago sitting next to Mr. Universe.
And bulging over the seat.
Very large. Yeah, his lats kept knocking my Bloody Mary off my tray. And, you know, I was talking about steroids, and, you know, he said, you know, in my business, it's impossible.
Without it.
And if you take a look at and he also said, you know, the natural competitions, those guys don't get endorsement deals. They don't get prize money. They don't get anyone. Nobody gives a crap who Mr. Natural is. They want to see Mr. Juiced Up Steroid.
Right.
And then also, you know, there's this thing where it's like, well, Lyle Alzado got a brain tumor when he was 38. And he says it's because he's juicing. But we all know people, housewives, have gotten brain tumors and died at 38.
We know that the steroids, the side effects of steroids are just debilitating, particularly in the megadoses the athletes took. Not just roid rage, not just the pimples, but a whole sets of things from cancer to heart disease to
but
whatever.
What's happened? I mean, do we have cadavers that we've examined?
Yeah. Because people have been doing it. The Nazis gave it. They were developed by German scientists, synthetic stuff, to make their soldiers more aggressive.
Usually and the, comes and out the, of the Virgin Islands. The cold. Are you saying the Nazis are behind this one?
Of course they're behind
wow.
it.
Wow.
And the Cold War, you know, the East Germans gave all everybody. And we started getting them in the 60s. And our Olympic athletes and then later some of our pro football and then pitchers started taking
well,
it.
Well, I mean, the pro football guys, you know, the head trauma stuff, we finally figured out not a great thing to get your bell rung, you know, 28 times in the course of a career. And so they dissect those guys' brains, and the guys in their 50s have brains of 80-year-olds.
Yep.
Whereas I don't know how old you are, Ken, but I see you as having a brain of like a 19-year-old when you're 80. I see you as a clean liver who exercises his brain quite a bit.
Pretty accurate there. Yeah. I'm 57, but I don't look it. I'm going to be a grandfather in
Insane.
6 months.
Well, yeah. I think it's not. I think a lot of time in a dark room.
That's
meets,
right. Out of the sun.
Meets no vices.
Some. Yeah.
Meets not a care in the world.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, no, me, not a care in the world. Somebody somebody asked me once, I live in this tiny little village in New Hampshire, and somebody'd come to the little greasy spoon breakfast place, and they said, how do you stay so young, this old lady? And I said, excessive worry and travel. So it may just be counterintuitive.
Really? So they have done autopsies on these Russian athletes and these German athletes, and they've found horrible things
that the steroids have done. But look, you know, the point about the steroids is not trying to legitimize that we should all be taking them and maybe the next generation of baseball players should be 7 feet tall and 3 feet wide and whatever it is, but that the players and the Players Association made this terrible decision to permit some to not test and therefore permit some people to advance because they did take it and others perhaps to fall back because they didn't want to ruin their bodies.
Well,
that's a Faustian bargain they made.
I'll tell you what happens is it's in my business a little bit, it's sort of like publicists and lawyers. They're evil, they're bad for you, they're expensive, no one wants to deal with them. But once a bunch of other people start lawyering up and publishing, they get a publicist, they get a lawyer. Now you need a publicist and a lawyer, or otherwise you can't compete.
That's right.
And so once you realize that Canseco's juicing, you go, well, I got to be competitive too.
He's the Typhoid Mary of it, and he made it happen, and that's what happened. We're also in an age, we sort of isolate the baseball players and see them in a vacuum and permit our moralization to take place. But in fact, these guys are in the same culture in which we advertise, Levitra and Viagra on daytime TV. We think that we can take a pill to make ourselves better in the bedroom. We can give our kids pills so they'll be better at school. And in the film, in the 10th inning, Chris Rock looks at me and says, if they made a pill that would have you be paid like Steven Spielberg, you'd take it. You would, And that's the dilemma that those middle infielders were facing. It's not just the big stars. It's the guy who says, man, if I do this, I might get that 5-year contract that will put me through till I'm 40. My family will be set. And, I'll be okay. Otherwise, if I don't do it, I might fall back to the AAA and I'm making nothing and I've got to, get some other thing going.
Well, baseball's one of the sports, I would say, different than basketball and even different than football.
Duh.
Where there's a lot of guys that are really, there's a handful of elite guys,
right.
And then there's just a massive amount of guys that were the star of their high school team, who played AAA, played some college ball, and those guys are almost interchangeable in the sense that they're a good outing away, a good at bat away from making it to the show versus playing for the Mud Hens for the rest of
their lives. Right.
And in basketball, when you got a guy who's just a big power forward and you can see that he's got that shot and he moves like a guard, he's just in. I mean, baseball is that one sport because size isn't as big a factor.
No, you don't have to be 7 feet tall or 7 feet wide or on skates.
That there's just a lot of guys that had a real legitimate shot of making
it
to the show.
And when you say what's the difference between a 275 hitter and a 300 hitter, it's just a couple of bloop singles, a month.
Right.
Literally, something falling in as opposed to being caught. And that's that's an amazingly, I mean, look, you fail 7 times out of 10 in baseball. You're
right.
a 300 hitter. You do it for 20 years, you're in the Hall of Fame. That's a lot of failure,
right?
And this is the only sport in which the defense has the ball.
Right.
The only sport without a clock, the only sport which has a rigid set of rules, but every outfield is different.
Yeah.
Every foul territory is different.
And
the man scores, not the ball.
Right.
Name me another sport in which, you know, you need the basket, the ball to go through the basket. You need to cross the end zone. You need to go in the cup. You need to
right.
do in this baseball. You know, the ball can be literally out of the park and you're scoring.
I know you think you like baseball now, but you're going to be throwing out the first pitch at the Dodger game.
Yeah.
You're not going to like baseball when you're done tossing out that first pitch.
I threw at Target Field 3 days ago, mm-hmm. I threw a strike.
Oh, really?
And to the fanatic who wasn't wearing a glove,
I
sort
fanatic.
Of pulled up a little bit at Citizens Bank, and I really grooved one in Texas. I threw out before Steven Strasburg's debut.
Wow.
Which was 40,000 people.
You're jinxing yourself.
Oh, you know it. But see, look. I'm keeping my day job. If I bounce it, what are they going to do? Oh, Burns, what's he doing? What does he think he is? But if I groove it, they go, whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the guy at Target come out who caught it, was a coach. He said, that's the first strike I've had all year.
Yeah,
you know?
I've done it a few times, never had a strike. You know why? They set you up to fail.
Of course they do.
They don't give you any warm-up pitches.
No warm-up
pitches.
And
they don't give you a mitt to wear.
I bring my mitt.
Oh,
I've got my
you?
Mitt with me.
A ringer.
I bring my
mitt. Because you need it for balance. You don't realize.
Because we don't throw like this. And you know, you get up on the mound, and the mound is also a problem, too, because you've all your life, you've never been throwing like this.
Yes.
So then you throw the guy. It's all in follow-through.
You need that balance.
It's all in follow-through.
The other thing, too, that drives me insane is I used to play baseball in high school, and one time got to go out to Vero Beach for just a man show bit and train with Tommy Lasorda and the Dodgers and had a great time.
Now, but there's a good, clean living guy.
he cusses more than people know.
And
I have a couple good Tommy Lasorda stories, but one of them.
They can't go on a family network show.
Oh, this isn't family. We can say whatever we want. Me and Jimmy were doing a parade for Mardi Gras in New Orleans that we were filling in for Tommy Lasorda, who pulled out at the last moment. So his wife told him, you're not going to New Orleans. You're not being Grand Marshal of a Mardi Gras parade 2 days before he was due to do it. So they asked Jimmy and I to fill in as
so to speak,
Grand Marshal. It's a pretty big cleats to fill, but
yeah.
We were able to fill in for the skipper. They didn't have time to change the beads that had a huge medallion of Tommy Lasorda's head on it. So
we were throwing out
beads, and it was the same thing. Everyone would catch the beads. They would go nuts.
I mean,
they put their kids up on A-frame ladders.
Exactly.
And put a coat hanger around the guy's head that's shaped like a basketball hoop. And they put their 3-year-old up on it. It's Child Protective Services.
I know.
Should just follow those parades around and just start rounding up people, because it's like, first off, it's a school day. What are your kids doing?
Right.
His diaper's full. You have on top a 9-foot A-frame ladder. He has a beer in his hand. He's yelling, show us
your
three.
Kids.
He's three. So everybody would chuck the beads, dude. They'd go nuts. And
then
you'd see him look at the beads.
They'd go, what?
They'd go, why is this 7-year-old fat guy? Why did Corolla... I don't think it even said Tommy Lasorda. It was just a picture of his head.
You had to know who he was.
You had to be a huge Dodger fan. So that was my Lasorda story. But a cool guy, and had fun playing with him. But once at a certain point, you make the switch from hardball to softball. And you just get used to playing these games with your buddies and your company, picnic and all that. Once you get used to chucking that softball,
it's hard.
And then someone puts a baseball back in your hands,
it's
like throwing a golf ball.
Oh, man, it's hard.
I'll tell you something I don't do, Ken, because chivalry is not dead at the Corolla house. When the girls come up in the softball game, I don't do that bullshit where I walk up to the edge of the infield.
Oh, yeah.
It gives them no shot at getting a hit.
Right.
What's up? I stay back there. If you want to hit a Texas leaguer and trot down to first base, it's perfectly okay.
I agree. Yeah. No. You don't move in
the
outfield.
There's always some guy or gal who thinks they have to stop at first base.
Yes.
They don't know they can run through it.
Yeah, right.
There's a couple things that drive me
like
nuts
some real
about
basic things.
The company softball game. One is the person who's either not from this country or is never somehow there's things that escape them about baseball.
And since the company picnic is so democratic, oh sure, you can play.
Right. They'll do the move. They'll be this guy. They'll be the person that stops on first base
right.
and gets out because they didn't run through it.
Right.
They'll then be the chick that runs through it but turns to her left and starts walking back to the bag.
And is tagged
then somebody
out.
Tags her
and
out.
And then you have to make that decision.
And then you do that thing where you go, Connie doesn't know.
Right.
And then the guy who's at first base is an a-hole. He's like, she's out.
Yeah.
And you're like, give her a break. She barely. Oh, and then. Female women's softball. I watched.
Could you hit any of that stuff?
No, I watched 10 minutes. You couldn't time it. It's like coming from underneath.
Yeah.
It's moving around. There's a hot chick doing it to you. It's distracting. She's wearing an eyeshadow. But there's a couple things that bother me in the ponytail about the women's softball. And you tell me what you think of this. So I watched the U.S. playing like Hungary and some international whatever at ESPN, you know, 2 a.m. the other. I was intrigued.
I was watching with you. We boosted the ratings.
Yeah. So I was watching. Now, the number one and the number two hitter do some kind of weird drag bunt chop.
Yeah, kind of an Ichiro thing where they're
Ichiro way out of the batter's box. The bag is 60 feet away, so all you got to do is get the ball on the ground and you can run it out. The shortstop who's charging fields it cleanly, gets it out of her mitt into the first baseman as fast as humanly possible.
And they're still safe.
They're still safe. So,
right.
A, you're ruining the sport. Because
right.
No, people, it'd be like someone saying, hey, we got a heavyweight fight, but only jabs, no right hand.
Everyone
wants to
with
see
both,
a haymaker.
With both the male version, too, because they throw it this lobbing underhand, which they put all this English on.
Right.
So if you're not like a gigantic linebacker who can crush it, it's going to just spurt away.
Yeah.
And then the women's stuff is too fast to hit.
Yes.
Then it dribbles down the...
The unlimited arc is a travesty.
So I'd
like to find the guy who invented the unlimited... Limited arc softball, just kick that guy right in the nuts.
I take the 4th of July game, you know, where you're throwing it.
Yeah.
Everybody gets a chance to hit it.
You tell
the
pitcher where you want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm not going to hit that junk that you're throwing me.
Throw
it again.
You know what pisses me off at the company softball game? When the guy rolls the first one in, throws the next one in
over
your head,
to the
back. Third one in, the catcher doesn't even have a shot at. Now he's getting ready to throw the fourth one in, and the guy in right field yells, come on, Burns.
Yeah, hit it.
We're not here all day.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, you want it served up on a silver platter? And you're like, none has come in that I can hit, but the pressure
right.
gets to you.
No. And then
now he throws one that's high.
Right.
You take
and you
a
swing
chop at it,
and
you pop out to the catcher.
Or ground to first base.
I hate that.
Yeah, I hate that too.
And I always promise myself, no first pitch win. No first.
No. And then it comes in so
boom.
Fat. And it's a
it's so fat. All right, but so the women, so I'm watching the women. First
you
off,
see why we had to take 4 hours to do this update. There's just so much.
The women need to wear caps, number one. I don't like the idea that they're wearing They're wearing visors like they're dealing blackjack in
right.
the 50s.
That's
like,
right.
I wear a baseball cap.
Right.
I don't like some of them wear visors, some of them don't.
Right.
And then they run out of the batter's box, slide. They do a technique where they let go of the bat. It slides through their hands. They grab it at about the halfway point.
Right.
They
and then
chop at it. They're 10 feet out of the batter's box. It's first off, why do we have a batter's box if your ass is going to be outside of it when you're making contact with the ball?
And they're wearing a short little skirt and knee socks,
yeah.
And they still have to slide.
Well, some of them wear the pads now. They've wised up.
The
number four hitter, by the way, in the slot, did a legitimate bunt.
Right.
You're hitting cleanup
and you're bunting.
You're bunting.
Yeah.
Of course people aren't falling in love with your sport.
Right.
You're not offering any.
It's
no one there. Everyone's
only
going
you
to the
and
UFC.
I are watching it at 2
We're
a.m.
The only two
on ESPN 7.
And I'm masturbating. I don't know why you're there. But the point is that this is why the UFC's taken over.
I'm studying baseball. We have an update to do. The 10th inning.
Sure.
That's why I'm there. It's homework.
It's homework.
It's
That's
homework.
What you tell
yeah.
your wife. So what is, speaking of your wife, what is the schedule like? What's a normal day for Ken Burns?
Well, I was on the road in 2009, 301 days, and when I told my best friend that my wife was unexpectedly pregnant, he said, that's great. Who's the father?
Right.
So We're on the road. So we do a lot of promoting. We do a lot of shooting remotely. But, you know, a typical day when we're at home is getting up and spending 10 hours in the editing room trying to make something better.
On site, you have
yeah.
your own
Yeah, in this little village in New Hampshire. Yeah, we got four or five avid bays, and we work on these, you know, series. You know, mm-hmm. I move from one room to another.
And when you're doing, I mean, I did a 90-minute independent film, and there's a lot of, you know, oh, it's dragging,
yep.
it feels too long, we're in the museum for too long, we need to cut it down. But when you're doing 19 hours
then
worth
then,
footage.
Then you've got that problem times 19, so it's always critical.
Really?
Yeah, oh, always. Yeah, we're always trying to figure out how to tell it right.
Do you have, I mean, like, when you're doing an independent comedy and your first cut comes in at 2 hours and 10 minutes, somebody will say, hey, man, you yeah. know, this thing's got to be 90 minutes. Do you do that?
Yeah.
Do you say, hey, man, this thing's got to be 17 hours?
Yeah. I mean, we've started, and sometimes the material just says it has to be this long, or that episode is going to be an hour and a half, or that episode's going to be 2 hours. And what's great about PBS is that if that hour has to be, or that episode has to be 2 hours and 5 minutes... Mm-hmm. I get 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Right.
And then they fill the other stuff with the
right.
making
it
of or conversation. And because who said everything had to come out to 52 minutes or 56 minutes or an hour
well,
and
like,
56 minutes?
You know, network primetime half hours like is like 20 minutes and 30 seconds or 21
yeah.
minutes, but it's not 23 and a half minutes.
Uh-uh.
It's that there's no accordion effect at
and
all.
Now everything's structured to the commercial breaks, so you know
right.
how to write in these little tiny things, and maybe that's not the way it goes. So the fact that we can have sometimes two and a half hours of clean, uninterrupted time on television is like unknown. I mean, you get it a little bit in the premium cable stuff, but
right.
they'd own it. I mean, PBS says, we want you to do it the way you want to do it.
How does the economics of it work?
It's totally different from anything else. It's all grant-funded, so we get corporate underwriting, not investment, about 25%. It's Bank of America in this case, and they've been fantastic. We get some from PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and every once in a while from the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the rest are foundations. And you got to go out and pound the pavement and get it. But then when you do it, you're free. You've got that wall, and you can deal with tough subject. As you know, I mean, the number one sub-theme of American life is race. And people don't want to talk about it, don't want to deal with it. It's in the front pages today, but no one will really come to terms. When Thomas Jefferson said, all men are created equal, he didn't sort of look back home and see that he had 100 people or more that worked for him, that he never saw that contradiction or hypocrisy, and more importantly, never saw fit in his lifetime to free any one of them. And so we deal with these difficult stuff. We deal with lots of complex themes, but still try to tell them in an engaging way.
How does it work for you? Because as far as your income goes,
yeah.
because it, in a way, or you tell me if this is right or wrong. I mean, I'm sure you make money doing speaking engagements.
We get paid
like
modestly for the budgets themselves. They get paid for speaking engagements. There's sometimes a companion book in which you can get some money if it does well. And then if the film does well, afterlife, like DVDs or foreign sales, it trickles down and you get a little bit, most of which gets just put right back into the next stuff. But you live in rural New Hampshire, you measure your richness just in far more ways than the bottom line. You know what I mean?
Well, I know for you.
And they haven't invented a pill that Chris Rock suggested that would have me be paid like Steven Spielberg.
Well, but, and now do you, I'm guessing you don't have a lot of expensive vices. I mean, you
know. No, the jet's in the shop. It's been up on blocks for a long time. The butler and the chauffeur and the maid and the valet are all, you know, on maternity leave.
But this is your life's.
Yeah.
Your work, your muse,
yeah.
your passion, it's all
yeah,
wrapped up
you know
into
what,
one
You know what,
spool,
Monday is
right?
not, like, anticipation of Monday is not a bummer. Friday is not, like, liberation. The
right.
people I work with are the people I play with. It's been, I feel like I got the best job in the country. It educates all my parts. I meet lots of very interesting people. I travel around the country. And you engage these things. You become, not an expert, but you just dive down deep for a couple years. But then you have to spend 40 years.
Right.
You can leave it alone. And, you know, my first film for PBS was on the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, I can talk to you for an hour about that. What's cool about that? And the next film was on the Shakers. I could talk to you for an hour about what's important about the Shakers, but I've also done 20 other films since then: Civil War and baseball and jazz, and I have biographies on Mark Twain and Frank Lloyd Wright and Lewis and Clark and Jack Johnson and the war stuff.
Did the guy, one of the architects of the Brooklyn Bridge, die of blood poisoning because he got his toe smashed by a barge?
Very good. His name was John Roebling. He was a German immigrant, the favorite student of Hegel, apparently. He came, he moved to Western Pennsylvania, and he saw that he could make a fortune doing wire rope instead of hemp rope because he watched these barges trying to go up over the Alleghenies break and crash and kill people. So he moved back to Trenton, started this wire company. He designs the Brooklyn Bridge. He's out on a ferry in this boat comes in, out on a dock, and a ferry comes in and crushes his foot. He dies of tetanus because he's hydropathous, which means he only does water cures.
Right, he wouldn't.
And so he wouldn't treat it. And his young son, Washington Roebling, who'd gotten his only training as an engineer in the Civil War, where he's building military bridges, takes over the greatest construction of the era. Now, and I haven't even brought in Boss Tweed and all the shenanigans of bad politics that would make today look kind of clean.
And speaking of today, could you do a project like that today? You could do it, but would it take twice as long and cost 10 times as much?
It would probably cost a lot more than it cost. I lived on 2 cents an hour. That's why I moved from New York to this little village, because I knew I had just taken this vow of anonymity and poverty by becoming a documentary filmmaker for PBS, focusing on American history. And then I'm happy that it didn't turn out that way, but I've used the sort of economic Spartan model of working to make it happen. Yeah, and the other thing is that there's a fire that takes place down in the caissons, these great wooden boxes the size of a city block, where they're down, men are in there excavating the river bottom, and then they're piling rocks on top of it, and then they get to bedrock and they fill this caisson with cement, and that's what the tower's going to be on. But they have to use compressed air to keep the water out.
Yeah.
So when they come up, they get the bends,
right?
So it's this hellish thing, and there was a fire in one of them. And that takes like 18 or 30 seconds in this original documentary I made. Like today, I know so much more that I could turn that fire into 5 minutes. So
yeah,
then you're talking
about...
Yeah,
the bends are basically just because it's sort of like the runs... And that it's named
so
after
bad.
Bending over.
No,
right?
No. I don't know why.
It got named the bends.
I guess because they were doubled over.
What
happens is that you have nitrogen as a gas in your bloodstream. When you're under extreme pressure, that gets pulverized and it reforms as a bubble. And those bubbles cause, a million little heart attacks. And people were dying in the Brooklyn Bridge of what was originally called, the technical military term, medical term, is caisson's disease, from the construction of bridges in the 19th century, specifically the Brooklyn Bridge.
So insane how what they needed to do, the technology that wasn't in place, now they just get some caisson rig and drill it, from a barge up above.
And every once in a while I stop on those cable channels where they're building the new super-duper bridge across the Japanese or Chinese thing, and you know what? They're building caissons. They got it all down, but it's the same sort of principle where you keep the sea out, and you put this box down, and you excavate until you hit bedrock, and then you fill that in and build your tower.
Yeah. Now it's just, it's actually the same with dental work, too, if you ever get dental implants. Everything's basically based on the caisson.
But they give
premise.
You some, and they don't tie it to a door.
Yeah, so the next, we have a Vietnam one coming up.
Wait, in 2015, before that is the Roosevelt's Central Park Jogger, Dust Bowl, and Prohibition is next.
Now, so what did you learn, obviously, you became an expert. You become an expert on all this stuff. Prohibition, as it pertains to, I guess, a lot of people draw the parallels to drugs. And
you know what? It's such a stupid parallel to draw. And the reason is, you can talk about that stuff, but drugs have always been parts of some very rare subcultures. Every culture drinks alcohol, it has fermented or distilled spirits. The real connection about Prohibition, to me, the thing that there's nothing new under the sun, is that this is a story about right-wing single-issue campaigns that metastasize. This is the story about the demonization of immigrants. This is the story about state and local governments complaining about unfunded mandates. This is the story of smear campaigns against Democrats. This is a story about unintended consequences. It is almost exactly what's going on now. It's the last gasp of Protestantism. Mm-hmm. We keep these Romanists from getting their wine. You know, we'll still be able to hold on. It's like a Tea Party thing. It's unbelievable.
Did it backfire on us?
Of course it did.
Well, I mean, I know it backfired, but to what extent?
In every degree.
Would we not have organized crime?
We probably wouldn't have organized crime to the extent that we have today. It made half the country lawbreakers. Female alcoholism, which was almost non-existent, confined to housewives taking Lydia Pinkham's vegetable compound, which was mostly made up of alcohol in the 19th century.
Oil.
And women unless you were a prostitute, you were never in a saloon, which is what the Anti-Saloon League wanted to get rid of. So when you get rid of the saloons, you replace them with speakeasies. There's no governance. Kids can drink and did. Women drank and female alcoholism becomes a huge social problem by the time Prohibition's over. And nothing ever cured alcohol.
Unintended consequence of Prohibition
huge.
Is bringing the women into the speakeasies.
It got passed because of a lot of different factors, but it also, after World War I, there's that typical after-the-war change in habits. And so women, the mothers who had worked so hard for temperance and then got suckered into accepting total temperance, teetotal
mm-hmm.
abstinence.
Oh,
that's where
yeah.
it comes from. You know, suddenly looked in horror as their daughters were bobbing their hair and their short skirts and they're not wearing bras and they're drinking and they're driving and they're, you know, it made half the country,
It never works.
It's a great
it always
story.
Bites you in the ass.
We start, that guy Mac Twain I was telling you about earlier?
Mark Twain.
We start the film with a quote from him. He says, "Nothing so needs reforming as other people's habits."
Right. Sure. I mean, it's so true when they say, "Should we add $2 to the pack of the price of a pack of cigarettes and give the money to the schools?" All the non-smokers' hands go up
my
kids are in
sense.
School
yeah, yeah.
and I don't smoke. Yeah, it's very dangerous. I saw a thing on Elliot Ness, Elliot Ness,
What's up, Doc?
Too long ago, and it turns out none of these heroes were heroes.
He doesn't make an appearance in our film.
We've got
some great bootleggers, guys who are like well-respected police lieutenants in Seattle and a well-respected defense attorney in Chicago, and they went, "I can make a lot more money as bootleggers." And became like the king of the Puget Sound bootleggers. And this one guy moved to Cincinnati. He was making like $6 million one year.
Wow.
Back when $6 million a year.
And so this sort of myth of Elliot Ness and the Untouchables and all that nonsense never really factored in.
Well, I mean,
he was trying to grab headlines.
Capone and Torrio in Chicago, they did live up to the hype for a while. But the problem is that trope of the rain-slick Chicago streets with the Model T careening around the corner, machine gun blasting, actually clears the territory for us from a much more interesting. We've got that in the film. It's in there, mm-hmm. and it's fun, and it's exciting. But the social transformations, the religious dimension, the century before of how it actually happened. I mean, these cynical right-wing politicians who allied themselves with progressives who wanted to balance. There was no income tax. And the beer and liquor industries were going, "There's no problem. The government gets more than half of its revenues from our industry. That's never going to happen." So they go in, and they say, "Yes, we agree in the redistribution of wealth. Let's pass an income tax." So they pass an income tax, and they don't need the tax money from the brewers and the distillers anymore. Then World War I comes along, and who's the enemy? The German Hun. Who makes beer in America? The Germans.
Sure.
So suddenly, you know, they're saying, the Anti-Saloon League is saying that the biggest enemies are Blatz and Anheuser and Schlitz and Miller.
Where do you
and,
think the Anti-Saloon League meets? You know what I mean? Because
you need to have a place.
Maybe an IHOP.
Well, there's also hypocrisy. The three chapters, it's 3 2-hour. The first one's A Nation of Drunkards. By the time distilled spirits came, presidents were drinking for breakfast. John Adams had, you know, a cup of hard cider. Hard cider. This is not what you have with donuts. Hard cider for breakfast. The second episode is called A Nation of Scofflaws, from when they first put the law into effect in 1920, and everybody broke it. And the last one is A Nation of Hypocrites, because Harding, who was an ardent dry, the president of the United States, had a whiskey cabinet every week. They got their liquor from a bootlegger. These guys that were, you know, voting the laws about Prohibition were continuing to drink.
Well, it breaks my heart every time I see one of that black and white footage of guys taking a fireman's axe to a barrel of beer, and it's going out into the gutter, and I'm like, no, no.
And washing down the
stairs. Yes, it's like,
yeah, we got a lot of that.
Oh, it's heartbreaking to see those barrels of beer going to the sewer system. I can't believe that this thing ever got any traction.
How
like
did
in
it happen?
19 or 20,
the moment began in 1820, and they started just building and building and building.
Really?
And building and building. And the Women's Christian Temperance Union came along, and they did lots of progressive education. Progressives liked it. Radicals liked it. Conservative liked it. You know, the big industrials didn't want their workers to get drunk. The communists, the wobblies, the socialists, they thought that liquor was this plot by the capitalists to keep the workers enslaved. Booker T. Washington thought that black people would be able to advance if they didn't get drunk. I mean, everybody was sort of for it, and they wanted it to be an amendment because no amendment had ever been repealed. So it was sort of locked in. Mm-hmm. It was cemented in. But of course, it's unintended consequences. It created so much damage. It did so much bad stuff that it's the only amendment that's ever been repealed.
Do you believe... Now, what do you think about... I was going to say, you know, America's, but the world's reliance on alcohol and sort of being altered. You know
well,
what I mean?
That, you know, this, there's this, a guy
why
said,
do we want to escape what is
oh,
with,
that's
with such a passion?
This universe is so chaotic and so random. And what we do is we invent religion and art and literature and love and conversation to superimpose some order on what's happened. And that's what we do over the chaos of what's going on. And we set a frame around it. If it's a painter or a photographer, we write about it. We try to control what seems to be the randomly uncontrollable events that happen. But shit does happen. And, you know, after a while,
that
sometimes...
That should be the name of your next doc.
Don't you think?
19 hours of shit happens.
Shit happens.
Just one minute,
and you
Larry
take a
Johnson
drink,
was fine,
and
then he tried
helps.
To clean his gutters
the
out, and he fell off, and he broke his neck and died.
What can you say?
Shit happens. Yeah. So you try to take a drink to...
And a drink helps you, just is one of those things that we've invented to sort of separate us from the mercilessness of what goes on in the world. And some people find in faith, but you see how that metastasized. Faiths are responsible for more deaths in the last 1,000 years than any other force.
I like you, Ken, because you don't like religion or white people. And that's exactly
well, you know, people said, well, I live
in
New England. Why don't you ski? And I said, I don't like a sport in which African Americans don't excel.
I am only here because Jimmy Kimmel made an off-colored remark about an African American skiing. Do you know that?
No.
I owe my entire career to Jimmy Kimmel making fun of Bobby McFerrin breaking his leg on a ski slope. He, story must have been out of 94. Bobby McFerrin was skiing the Don't Worry, Be Happy guy. And I'm sure
I'm
know about
guy.
Him. And he broke his leg on a ski slope. Jimmy, who was doing sports for...
Ran with it
and said, what's a brother skiing for? The brother he... worked with on the radio station, Michael the maintenance man, ran in and got angry, took umbrage with that statement, challenged him to a boxing match. I was working as a boxing instructor at the time, heard it on the radio, and decided to volunteer my services to train one of the guys. For the match, ended up with Jimmy, and the rest, as they say, is history. But... the only reason I'm here, really, is because he made fun of a black guy skiing.
I get it. Well, see, I just think that you should be careful about making fun of it, not because of it might cause you to get into a fight, but because when African Americans do turn their attention to skiing...
That's it.
Look out.
It's just silver and bronze from that point on.
If you're lucky.
That's the problem.
We always put African American, we put Black History in February, which is our coldest and shortest month, as if it's the politically correct addendum to our national narrative, when in fact African American history is at the center, the burning center of American history. When Thomas Jefferson said all men are created equal and he doesn't deal with it, he set in motion an American narrative that's going to be not only bedeviled but also ennobled by a question of race. The only art form that we've invented, Jay, Baz, is born in a community of people who have had the peculiar experience.
You mean America.
America's, our art form. People that are unfree in a free land. I mean, this has been, our genius is improvisation, and if you're a slave in America, you've got to improvise a hell of a lot more than anybody else. And so a great deal of our music, our culture, the dynamics, the soul of the country is built on the backs first of African-American labor and then of African-American experience. And rather than putting it in February, it could be we could consider it in a different light.
Well, what would you do then if you were in charge and, you know, the black community is not thriving as well as you would probably and I would probably like it? And I think there's a sort of a fundamental problem, which is when Bill Cosby says, you know, pull your pants up and speak English and get good grades, and you know what, you getting an A on an algebra test doesn't make you a sellout to your race, people come down on Bill Cosby, or at least people in that community come down on Bill Cosby.
But that presupposes that that community is the dominant African-American community, and it is not. It's a fraction. I think it just goes back, Chris Rock understands it. He says, I'm a millionaire, and you would not trade places with me for anything. And he's right. And
oh, really?
Until that moment when we would go, oh yeah, I'll be Chris Rock. I will be him. Mm-hmm. Until we then there's work to do. And I'm not sure you can legislate that work. I'm not sure you can say that it's just as simple as pull your pants up. Of course, discipline and self-discipline is about it. But we have African-American examples. I mean, this is a race that's called lazy and shiftless. They worked 14 hours a day as slaves. And when there was a full moon, they worked more. And we're suddenly our default position for all African-Americans is somehow they're lazy and shiftless. This is the people that we were lazy and shiftless, and we wanted them to do all the work for us, right? And now we're upset because of...
Well, we were smart, lazy, and shiftless, I mean, to be fair to us. But like Chris Rock, I do think Ken Burns probably wouldn't want to trade places with him. But,
well, no, I'm closer to that. It's so interesting.
But you think most people would?
No, and he's absolutely right. I'm closer to doing that. I mean, because we've engaged so many African-American themes in our films, because if you scratch the surface of American history, I don't go looking for it. It's not politically correct pursuit of this stuff, but it's there. It's always there. And people say we're post-racial. Yeah, right. You know, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was given 10 years to clean up the Depression, and he didn't do it, and World War II was the greatest stimulus program. A year later, you know, blamed the black guy for everything, you know, TARP, well before it happened, before his watch. It's his problem, you know, all of these different things. I get responses from African Americans like, somebody got it. Like, you understand the dynamic. We aren't just all the baggy pants guys. It's not all a rap song. It's not all this. And that's a legitimate manifestation of culture, too. I'm not even denigrating any of that. I'm just saying that we will be able to live out the full meaning of our creed, as Dr. King himself said, when we figure out how to deal with it. And where Chris Rock is finally wrong.
And
about switching places. And he would be the first to say that is true. But no matter what it was.
I was trying to picture if his wife was hot or not. I mean, I was going through my brain trying to figure out...
What aspects of his life you'd like?
Well, I mean, hanging out with Adam Sandler, that part would be cool.
That would be very cool.
I think his wife's attractive.
A black man in America still, you know, driving while black, you know, job, housing, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, but see, for Rock, I figure that's all right. Like, he's not going to... He could... The commune who runs the condo association in Manhattan is going to have him in, right? He's Chris Rock. Maybe. But we're saying a Chris Rock.
He lives in a neighborhood. He said in New Jersey, suburb of New York City, where he's like one of two black guys in his neighborhood, and it's only because I'm a multimillionaire.
Right.
You know?
And you are amongst nothing but white people in your neighborhood, correct?
Yeah, our hood is pretty, pretty lily white, at least in New Hampshire, yeah.
Donnie, how much time do we have? What time is it? Is it
1 hour.
Oh, 1 hour? All right.
We got to get back to the studio, too, you
have
to.
Oh, okay. Well, Ken, you know, I feel like, first off, I feel like you locked up in a dark edit bay 10 hours out of the day is like taking the Mona Lisa and putting it in someone's basement. I feel like there's so much more. I've interviewed
you. I love
you.
My job.
I know you're good at it. Don't get me wrong. But I've interviewed you 2 times, I believe. And I'm always so impressed at how how opinionated you are and how articulate you are and your wealth of knowledge. And it's you really should be on The View or something. I mean,
right.
I mean, full time. I mean, there's so many people on television who's their education's a little suspect. Their sense of humor is a little suspect. Their knowledge pool's a little suspect. Have you been approached to do shows?
I love my job. It's so great. And I love doing that and then coming out and sharing the film. And that evangelical dimension is as important as being locked in that editing room or being out shooting, you know, the national parks at 3 a.m. at the rim of the Grand Canyon. All that stuff works, including this. And I love that part of it. But I don't think I'd be the same if that's all I did. I watch friends of mine who go out on the speaking circuit and that's all they do. I sort of do enough to survive. But they just become their rap. Mm-hmm. And then you know, that's what you're looking at TV. It's not so much that they're not that smart or whatever, is that they're just doing it all the time. And they need, and I get experience. I get exposed to real life stuff. I got three daughters and something on the way and a grandkid. You know, I mean, that's enough to give you real life experience. Yeah.
Wow.
What, meaning a boy
yes,
or a girl?
I got that. Yeah. Well, I'm tickled pink for your success. And, you know, about the greatest compliment I think you could pay to almost anyone is when people think of a smart guy, they just throw out Einstein. You know, when they're making an example, they go, listen, I'm no idiot. I'm no Einstein. You know, they do that. I think Ken Burns, if someone is using, you know, a documentary filmmaker, I think you're about the first name anyone can summon.
Well, that's right.
And that's, you're the Frank Lloyd Wright of doc,
well,
you know.
Well, that's a very nice thing to
well,
say.
What I mean
but
is,
I'm a nicer guy than Frank Lloyd Wright.
He was
a real
an a-hole?
Son of a bitch.
Well,
yeah.
When you're good at
Skipped
what you
out
do.
Skipped out on Predators, cheated on his wife.
Really?
Yeah.
I got to rewatch your doc
yeah.
on
yeah.
him.
Yeah, Lynn and I made that in 98.
It is, by the way, the 10th inning, and it premieres September 28th and 29th on PBS. We'll be watching.
I can't wait for you to see it. I'm so excited by
really?
By this thing, yeah.
I love sports, and I of course, will be watching it. And Ken, anytime you're in town or anytime we can get a phoner going.
Anytime.
We'd,
I love it.
Love
Every
it.
Conversation, I love it.
Thanks. Ken Burns, everybody.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you.